It looked, in fact, as if someone had rammed the lock's keyway full of gunpowder and then set a match to it. Flowers of metal, deadly sharp, stood out from the body of the lock in a stiff spray. Stan could see the layers of steel inside. The thick hasp hung askew by one bolt, which had been yanked 3/4 of the way out of the wood. The other 3 hasp bolts lay on the wet grass. They had been twisted like pretzels. Frowning, Stan swung the door open again and peered inside. Narrow stairs led upward, circling around and out of sight. The outer wall of the staircase was bare wood supported by giant crossbeams, which had been pegged together rather than nailed. To Stan, some of the pegs looked thicker than his own upper arm. The inner wall was steel from which gigantic rivets swelled like boils. "Is anyone here?" Stan asked. There was no answer. He hesitated, then stepped inside so he could see up the narrow throat of the staircase a little better. Nothing. And it was Creep City in here, as Richie would also say. He turned to leave and heard music. It was faint, but still instantly recognizable. Calliope music. He cocked his head, listening, the frown on his face starting to dissolve a little. Calliope music, all right. The music of carnivals and county fairs. It conjured up trace memories which were as delightful as they were ephemeral. Popcorn, cotton candy, doughboys frying in hot grease, the chain-driven clatter of rides like the Wild Mouse, the Whip, the Coaster Cups. Now the frown had become a tentative grin. Stan went up one step, then 2 more, head still cocked. He paused again, as if thinking about carnivals could actually create one. He could now actually smell the popcorn, the cotton candy, the doughboys, and more. Peppers, chili dogs, cigarette smoke, and sawdust. There was the sharp smell of white vinegar, the kind you could shake over your French fries through a hole in the tin cap. He could smell mustard, bright yellow and stinging hot, that you spread in your hot dog with a wooden paddle. This was amazing, incredible, irresistible. He took another step up, and that was when he heard the rustling, eager footsteps above him, descending the stairs. He cocked his head again. The calliope music had gotten suddenly louder, as if to mask the sound of the footsteps. He could recognize the tune now. It was Camptown Races. Footsteps, yeah, but they weren't exactly rustling footsteps, were they? They actually sounded kind of squishy, didn't they? The sound was like people walking in rubbers full of water. Camptown ladies sing this song, doo-da, doo-da, squish, squish. Camptown racetrack 9 miles long, doo-da, doo-da, squish, splash. Closer now. Ride around all night, ride around all day. Now there were shadows bobbing on the wall above him. The terror leaped down Stan's throat all at once. It was like swallowing something hot and horrible, bad medicine that suddenly galvanized you like electricity. It was the shadows that did it. He saw them only for a moment. He had just that small bit of time to observe that there were 2 of them, that they were slumped and somehow unnatural. He had only that moment because the light in here was fading, fading too fast, and as he turned, the heavy standpipe door swung ponderously shut behind him. Stanley ran back down the stairs. Somehow he had climbed more than a dozen, although he could only remember climbing 2, 3 at most. Very much afraid now. It was too dark in here to see anything. He could hear his own breathing. He could hear the calliope tootling away somewhere above him. What's a calliope doing up there in the dark? Who's playing it? And he could hear those wet footsteps approaching him now, getting closer. He hit the door with his hands splayed out in front of him, hit it hard enough to send sparkly tingles of pain all the way up to his elbows. It had swung so easily before, and now it would not move at all. No, that was not quite true. At first it had moved just a bit, just enough for him to see a mocking strip of gray light running vertically down its left side. Then gone again, as if someone was on the other side of it, holding the door closed. Panting, terrified, Stan pushed against the door with all of his strength. He could feel the brass bindings digging into his hands. Nothing. He whirled around, now pressing his back and his splayed hands against the door. He could feel sweat, oily and hot, running down his forehead. The calliope music had gotten louder yet. It drifted and echoed down the spiral staircase. There was nothing cheery about it now. It had changed. It had become a dirge, It screamed like wind and water, and in his mind's eye, Stan saw a county fair at the end of autumn. Wind and rain blowing up a deserted midway. Pennons flapping, tents bulging, falling over, wheeling away like canvas bats. He saw empty rides standing against the sky like scaffolds. The wind drummed and hooted in the weird angles of their struts. He suddenly understood that death was in this place with him, that death was coming for him out of the dark, and he could not run. A sudden rush of water spilled down the stairs. Now it was not popcorn and doughboys and cotton candy he smelled, but wet decay, the stench of dead pork which has exploded in a fury of maggots in a place hidden away from the sun. "Who's here?" he screamed in a high, trembling voice. He was answered by a low, bubbling voice that seemed choked with mud and old water. "The dead ones, Stanley. We're the dead ones. We sank, but now we float. And you'll float, too." He could feel water washing around his feet. He cringed back against the door in an agony of fear. They were very close now. He could feel their nearness. He could smell them. Something was digging into his hip as he struck the door again and again in a mindless, useless effort to get away. "We're dead, but sometimes we clown around a little, Stanley. Sometimes we..." It was his bird book. Without thinking, Stan grabbed for it. It was stuck in his slicker pocket and wouldn't come out. One of them was down now. He could hear it shuffling across the little stone areaway where he had come in. It would reach for him in a moment, and he would feel its cold flesh. He gave one more tremendous yank, and the bird book was in his hands. He held it in front of him like a puny shield, not thinking of what he was doing, but suddenly sure that this was right. "Robins!" he screamed into the darkness, and for a moment the thing approaching, it was surely less than 5 steps away now, hesitated. He was almost sure it did. And for a moment, hadn't he felt some give in the door against which he was now cringing? But he wasn't cringing anymore. He was standing up straight in the darkness. When had that happened? No time to wonder. Stan licked his dry lips and began to chant. "Robins, gray egrets, loons, scarlet tanagers, grackles, hammerhead woodpeckers, red-headed woodpeckers, chickadees, wrens, pellet..." The door opened with a protesting scream, and Stan took a giant step backward into thin, misty air. He fell sprawling on the dead grass. He had bent the bird book nearly in half, and later that night he would see the clear impressions of his fingers sunken into its cover, as if it had been bound in Play-Doh instead of hard pressboard. He didn't try to get up, but began to dig in with his heels instead, his butt grooving through the slick grass. His lips were pulled back over his teeth. Inside that dim oblong, he could see 2 sets of legs below the diagonal shadow line thrown by the door, which now stood half open. He could see jeans that had decayed to a purplish black. Orange threads lay plastered limply against the seams, and water dripped from the cuffs to puddle around shoes that had mostly rotted away, revealing swelled purple toes within. Their hands lay limply at their sides, too long, too waxy white. Depending from each finger was a small orange pom-pom. Holding his bent bird book in front of him, his face wet with drizzle, sweat, and tears, Stan whispered in a husky monotone, "Chicken hawks, grosbeaks, hummingbirds, albatrosses, kiwis." One of those hands turned over, showing a palm from which endless water had eroded all the lines, leaving something as idiot smooth as the hand of a department store dummy. One finger unrolled, then rolled up again. The pom-pom bounced and dangled, dangled and bounced. It was beckoning him. Stan Uris, who would die in a bathtub with crosses slashed into his forearms 27 years later, got to his knees, then to his feet, then ran. He ran across Kansas Street without looking either way for traffic and paused, panting, on the far sidewalk to look back. From this angle, he couldn't see the door and the base of the standpipe. Only the standpipe itself, thick and yet somehow graceful, standing in the murk. "They were dead," Stan whispered to himself, shocked. He wheeled suddenly and ran for home. 11. The dryer had stopped. So had Stan. The three others only looked at him for a long moment. His skin was nearly as gray as the April evening of which he had just told them. "Wow," Ben said at last. He let out his breath in a ragged, whistling sigh. "It's true," Stan said in a low voice. "I swear to God it is." "I believe you," Beverly said. after what happened at my house. I'd believe anything. She got up suddenly, almost knocking over her chair, and went to the dryer. She began to pull out the rags, one by one, folding them. Her back was turned, but Ben suspected she was crying. He wanted to go to her and lacked the courage. "We gotta talk to Bill about this," Eddie said. "Bill will know what to do."
"Do?" Stan said, turning to look at him.
"What do you mean, do?"
Eddie looked at him, uncomfortable.
"Well, I don't want to do anything," Stan said. He was looking at Eddie with such a hard, fierce stare that Eddie squirmed in his chair.
"I want to forget about it. That's all I want to do."
"Not that easy," Beverly said quietly, turning around. Ben had been right. The hot sunlight slanting in through the Washateria's dirty windows reflected off bright lines of tears on her cheeks.
"It's not just us. I heard Ronnie Grogan, and the little boy I heard first. I think maybe it was that little Clemens kid, the one who disappeared off his trike."
"So what?" Stan said defiantly.
"So what if it gets more?" she asked. "What if it gets more kids?"
His eyes, a hot brown, locked with her blue ones, answering the question without speaking.
"So what if it does?"
But Beverly did not look down or away, and at last Stan dropped his own eyes, perhaps only because she was still crying, but perhaps because her concern somehow made her stronger.
"Eddie's right," she said. "We ought to talk to Bill, then maybe to the police chief."
"Right," Stan said. If he was trying to sound contemptuous, it didn't work. His voice came out sounding only tired.
"Dead kids in the standpipe. Blood that only kids can see, not grown-ups. Clowns walking on the canal, balloons that blow against the wind, mummies, lepers under porches. Chief Borton will laugh his bum off and then stick us in the loony bin."
"If we all went to him," Ben said, troubled, "if we all went together."
"Sure," Stan said. "Right. Tell me more, Haystack. Write me a book."
He got up and went to the window, hands in pockets, looking angry and upset and scared. He stared out for a moment, shoulders stiff and rejecting beneath his neat shirt. Without turning back to them, he repeated, "Write me a frigging book."
"No," Ben said quietly. "Bill's going to write the books."
Stan wheeled back, surprised, and the others looked at him. There was a shocked look on Ben Hanscom's face, as if he had suddenly and unexpectedly slapped himself. Bev folded the last of the rags.
"Birds," Eddie said.
"What?"
Bev and Ben said together.
Eddie was looking at Stan.
"You got out by yelling birds' names at them?"
"Maybe," Stan said reluctantly. "Or maybe the door was just stuck and finally popped open."
"Without you leaning on it?" Bev asked.
Stan shrugged. It was not a sullen shrug. It only said he didn't know.
"I think it was the birds you shouted at them," Eddie said. "But why? In the movies you hold up a cross."
"Or say the Lord's Prayer," Ben added.
"Or the 23rd Psalm," Beverly put in.
"I know the 23rd Psalm," Stan said angrily, "but I wouldn't do so good with the old crucifix business. I'm Jewish, remember?"
They looked away from him, embarrassed, either for his having been born that way or for their having forgotten it.
"Birds," Eddie said again. "Jesus." Then he glanced guiltily at Stan again, but Stan was looking moodily across the street at the Bangor Hydro office.
"Bill will know what to do," Ben said suddenly, as if finally agreeing with Bev and Eddie. "Bet you anything. Bet you any amount of money."
"Look," Stan said, looking at all of them earnestly,
"that's okay. We can talk to Bill about it if you want. But that's where things stop for me. You can call me a chicken or yellow. I don't care. I'm not a chicken, I don't think. It's just that those things in the standpipe."
"If you weren't afraid of something like that, you'd have to be crazy, Stan," Beverly said softly.
"Yeah, I was scared. But that's not the problem," Stan said hotly. "It's not even what I'm talking about. Don't you see?"
They were looking at him expectantly, their eyes both troubled and faintly hopeful, but Stan found he could not explain how he felt. The words had run out. There was a brick of feeling inside him, almost choking him, and he could not get it out of his throat. Neat as he was, sure as he was still only an 11-year-old boy who had that year finished the fourth grade. He wanted to tell them that there were worse things than being frightened. You could be frightened by things like almost having a car hit you while you were riding your bike, or before the Salk vaccine, getting polio. You could be frightened of that crazy man, Khrushchev, or of drowning if you went out over your head. You could be frightened of all those things and still function.
But those things in the standpipe. He wanted to tell them that those dead boys who had lurched and shambled their way down the spiral staircase had done something worse than frighten him. They had offended him. Offended, yes. It was the only word he could think of. And if he used it, they would laugh. They liked him, he knew that, and they had accepted him as one of them. But they would still laugh. All the same, there were things that were not supposed to be. They offended any sane person's sense of order. They offended the central idea that God had given the earth a final tilt on its axis so that twilight would only last about 12 minutes at the equator and linger for an hour or more up where the Eskimos built their ice cube houses. That he had done that, and he then had said, in effect, "Okay, if you can figure out the tilt, you can figure out any damn thing you choose. Because even light has weight, and when the note of a train whistle suddenly drops, it's the Doppler effect. And when an airplane breaks the sound barrier, that bang isn't the applause of the angels or the flatulence of demons, but only air collapsing back into place. I gave you the tilt, and then I sat back about halfway up the auditorium to watch the show. I got nothing else to say except that 2 and 2 makes 4. The lights in the sky are stars. If there's blood, grown-ups can see it as well as kids. And dead boys stay dead. You can live with fear, I think, Stan would have said if he could. Maybe not forever, but for a long, long time. It's a fence you maybe can't live with, because it opens up a crack inside your thinking. And if you look down into it, you see there are live things down there, and they have little yellow eyes that don't blink. And there's a stink down in that dark, and after a while you think maybe there's a whole other universe down there, a universe where a square moon rises in the sky and the stars laugh in cold voices. And some of the triangles have 4 sides, and some have 5, and some of them have 5 raised to the 5th power of sides. In this universe, there might grow roses which sing. Everything leads to everything, he would have told them if he could. Go to your church and listen to your stories about Jesus walking on the water, but if I saw a guy doing that, I'd scream and scream and scream, because it wouldn't look like a miracle to me. It would look like an offense. Because he could say none of these things, he just reiterated, "Being scared isn't the problem. I just don't want to be involved in something that will land me in the nut hatch." "Will you at least go with us to talk to him?" Bev asked. "Listen to what he says?" "Sure," Stan said, and then laughed. "Maybe I ought to bring my bird book." They all laughed then, and it was a little easier. 12. Beverly left them outside the clean clothes and took the rags back home by herself. The apartment was still empty. She put them under the kitchen sink and closed the cupboard. She stood up and looked down toward the bathroom. "I'm not going down there," she thought. "I'm going to watch Bandstand on TV. See if I can't learn how to do the dog." So she went into the living room and turned on the TV, and 5 minutes later she turned it off while Dick Clark was showing how much oil just one Stridex medicated pad could take off the face of your average teenager. "If you think you can get clean with just soap and water," Dick said, holding the dirty pad up to the glassy eye of the camera so that every teenager in America could get a good look, "you ought to take a good look at this." She went back to the kitchen cupboard over the sink where her father kept his tools. Among them was a pocket tape, the kind that runs out a long yellow tongue of inches. She folded this into one cold hand and went down to the bathroom. It was sparkling clean, silent. Somewhere, far distant, it seemed, she could hear Mrs. Doyen yelling for her boy Jim to get in out of the road right now. She went to the bathroom basin and looked down into the dark eye of the drain. She stood there for some time, her legs as cold as marble inside her jeans, her nipples feeling sharp enough and hard enough to cut paper, her lips dead dry. She waited for the voices. No voices came. A little shuddery sigh came from her, and she began to feed the thin steel tape into the drain. It went down smoothly, like a sword into the gullet of a county fair sideshow performer. 6 inches, 8 inches, 10. It stopped, bound up in the elbow bend under the sink, Beverly supposed. She wiggled it, pushing gently at the same time, and eventually the tape began to feed into the drain again. 16 inches now, then 2 feet, then 3. She watched the yellow tape slipping out of the chromed steel case, which had been worn black on the sides by her father's big hand. In her mind's eye, she saw it sliding through the black bore of the pipe, picking up some muck, scraping away flakes of rust. Down there where the sun never shines and the night never stops, she thought. She imagined the head of the tape, with its small steel butt plate no bigger than a fingernail, sliding farther and farther into the darkness. And part of her mind screamed, "What are you doing?" She did not ignore that voice, but she seemed helpless to heed it. She saw the end of the tape going straight down now, descending into the cellar. She saw it striking the sewage pipe, and even as she saw it, the tape bound up again. She wiggled it again, and the tape, thin enough to be limber, made a faint, eerie sound that reminded her a little bit of the way a saw sounds when you bend it back and forth across your legs. She could see its tip wiggling against the bottom of this wider pipe, which would have a baked ceramic surface. She could see it bending. And then she was able to push it forward again. She ran out 6 feet, 7, 9. And suddenly the tape began to run through her hands by itself, as if something down there was pulling the other end. Not just pulling it, running with it. She stared at the flowing tape, her eyes wide, her mouth a sagging O of fear. Fear, yes, but no surprise. Hadn't she known? Hadn't she known something like this was going to happen? The tape ran out to its final stop, 18 feet, and even 6 yards. A soft chuckle came wafting out of the drain, followed by a low whisper that was almost reproachful. "Beverly, Beverly, Beverly, you can't fight us. You'll die if you try, die if you try, die if you try. Beverly, 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 Lee, Lee, Lee." Something clicked inside the tape measure's housing, and it suddenly began to run rapidly back into its case, the numbers and hash marks blurring by. Near the end, the last 5 or 6 feet, the yellow became a dark, dripping red, and she screamed and dropped it on the floor as if the tape had suddenly turned into a live snake. Fresh blood trickled over the clean, white porcelain of the basin and back down into the drain's wide eye. She bent, sobbing now, her fear a freezing weight in her stomach, and picked the tape up. She tweezed it between the thumb and first finger of her right hand and, holding it in front of her, took it into the kitchen. As she walked, blood dripped from the tape onto the faded linoleum of the hall and the kitchen. She steadied herself by thinking of what her father would say to her, what he would do to her, if he found that she had gotten his measuring tape all bloody. Of course, he wouldn't be able to see the blood, but it helped to think that. She took one of the clean rags, still as warm as fresh bread from the dryer, and went back into the bathroom. Before she began to clean, she put the hard rubber plug in the drain, closing that eye. The blood was fresh, and it cleaned up easily. She went up her own trail, wiping away the dime-sized drops on the linoleum, then rinsing the rag, wringing it out, and putting it aside. She got a second rag and used it to clean her father's measuring tape. The blood was thick, viscous. In two places there were clots of the stuff, black and spongy. Although the blood only went back 5 or 6 feet, she cleaned the entire length of the tape, removing from it all traces of pipe muck. That done, she put it back into the cupboard over the sink and took the 2 stained rags out in back of the apartment. Mrs. Doyen was yelling at Jim again. Her voice was clear, almost bell-like, in the still hot late afternoon. In the backyard, which was mostly bare dirt, weeds, and clotheslines, there was a rusty incinerator. Beverly threw the rags into it, then sat down on the back steps. Tears came suddenly, with surprising violence, and this time she made no effort to hold them back. She put her arms on her knees, her head in her arms, and wept while Mrs. Doyen called for Jim to come out of that road. Did he want to get hit by a car and be killed? Derry, the second interlude. Quaeque ipsa miseri mavidi, et quorum pars magna fui. Virgil. You don't fuck around with the infinite. Mean streets. February 14th, 1985, Valentine's Day. 2 more disappearances in the past week, both children. Just as I was beginning to relax. One of them a 16-year-old boy named Dennis Torrio, the other a girl of just 5 who was sledding in back of her house on West Broadway. The hysterical mother found her sled, one of those blue plastic flying saucers, but nothing else. There had been a fresh fall of snow the night before, 4 inches or so. No tracks but hers, Chief Rademacher said when I called him. He is becoming extremely annoyed with me, I think. Not anything that's going to keep me awake nights. I have worse things to do than that, don't I? Asked him if I could see the police photos. He refused. Asked him if her tracks led away toward any sort of drain or sewer grating. This was followed by a long period of silence. Then Rademacher said, I'm beginning to wonder if maybe you shouldn't see a doctor, Hanlon. The head peeper kind of doctor. The kid was snatched by her father. Don't you read the papers? Was the Toyo boy snatched by his father? I asked. Another long pause. Give it a rest, Hanlon, he said. Give me a rest. He hung up. Of course I read the papers. Don't I put them out in the reading room of the public library each morning myself? The little girl, Lori-Ann Winterbarger, had been in the custody of her mother following an acrimonious divorce proceeding in the spring of 1982. The police are operating on the theory that Horst Winterbarger, who was supposedly working as a machinery maintenance man somewhere in Florida, drove up to Maine to snatch his daughter. They further theorize that he parked his car beside the house and called to his daughter, who then joined him, hence the lack of any tracks other than the little girl's. They have less to say about the fact that the girl had not seen her father since she was two. Part of the deep bitterness which accompanied the Winterbarger's divorce came from Mrs. Winterbarger's allegations that on at least two occasions, Horst Winterbarger had sexually molested the child. She asked the court to deny Winterbarger all visitation rights, a request the court granted in spite of Winterbarger's hot denials. Rademacher claims the court's decision, which had the effect of cutting Winterbarger off completely from his only child, may have pushed Winterbarger into taking his daughter. That, at least, has some dim plausibility, but ask yourself this. Would little Lori-Ann have recognized him after 3 years and run to him when he called her? Rademacher says yes, even though she was two the last time she saw him. I don't think so. And her mother says Lori-Ann had been well-trained about not approaching or talking to strangers, a lesson most dairy children learn early and well. Rademacher says he's got Florida State Police looking for Winterbarger and that his responsibility ends there. Matters of custody are more the province of the lawyers than that of the police, this pompous, overweight asshole is quoted as saying in last Friday's Dairy News. But the Toyo boy, that's something else. Wonderful home life. Played football for the Derry Tigers, honor roll student. Had gone through the Outward Bound Survival School in the summer of 84 and passed with flying colors. No history of drug use. Had a girlfriend that he was apparently head over heels about. Had everything to live for, everything to stay in Derry for, at least for the next couple of years. All the same, he's gone. What happened to him? A sudden attack of wanderlust? A drunk driver who maybe hit him, killed him, and buried him? Or is he maybe still in Derry? Is he maybe on the night side of Derry, keeping company with folks like Betty Ripsom and Patrick Hochstetter and Eddie Corcoran and all the rest? Is it... Later. I'm doing it again. Going over and over the same ground, doing nothing constructive, only cranking myself up to the screaming point. I jump when the iron stairs leading up to the stacks creak. I jump at shadows. I find myself wondering how I'd react if I was shelving books up there in the stacks, pushing my little rubber wheel trolley in front of me, and a hand reached from between two leaning rows of books, a groping hand. Had again a well-nigh insurmountable desire to begin calling them this afternoon. At one point, I even got as far as dialing 404, the Atlanta area code, with Stanley Uris's number in front of me. Then I just held the phone against my ear, asking myself if I wanted to call them because I was really sure, 100% sure, or simply because I'm now so badly spooked that I can't stand to be alone, that I have to talk to someone who knows, or will know, what it is I am spooked about. For a moment, I could hear Richie saying, Batches? Batches? We don't need no stinking batches, Senhor, in his poncho vanilla voice, as clearly as if he were standing beside me. And I hung up the phone. Because when you want to see someone as badly as I wanted to see Richie, or any of them, at that moment, you just can't trust your own motivations. We lie best when we lie to ourselves. The fact is, I'm still not 100% sure. If another body should turn up, I will call. But for now, I must suppose that even such a pompous ass as Rademacher may be right. She could have remembered her father. There may have been pictures of him. And I suppose a really persuasive adult could talk a kid into coming to his car, no matter what that child had been taught. There's another fear that haunts me. Rademacher suggested that I might be going crazy. I don't believe that, but if I call them now, they may think I'm crazy. Worse than that, what if they should not remember me at all? Mike Hanlon? Who? I don't remember any Mike Hanlon. I don't remember you at all. What promise? I feel that there will come a right time to call them, and when that time comes, I'll know that it's right. Their own circuits will open at the same time. It's as if there are two great wheels slowly coming into some sort of powerful convergence with each other, myself and the rest of Derry on one, and all my childhood friends on the other. When the time comes, they will hear the voice of the turtle. So I'll wait, and sooner or later I'll know. I don't believe it's a question anymore of calling them or not calling them. Only a question of when. February 20th, 1985. The fire at the Black Spot. A perfect example of how the Chamber of Commerce will try to rewrite history, Mike, old Albert Carson would have told me, probably cackling as he said it. They'll try, and sometimes they almost succeed. But the old people remember how things really went. They always remember. And sometimes they'll tell you, if you ask them right. There are people who have lived in Derry for 20 years and don't know that there was once a special barracks for non-coms at the old Derry Army Air Corps base, a barracks that was a good half a mile from the rest of the base. And in the middle of February, with the temperature standing right around zero and a 40-mile-an-hour wind howling across those flat runways and whopping the wind chill factor down to something you can hardly believe, that extra half a mile became something that could give you frost freeze or frostbite, or maybe even kill you. The other seven barracks had oil heat, storm windows, and insulation. They were toasty and cozy. The special barracks, which housed the 27 men of Company E, was heated by a bulky old wood furnace. Supplies of wood for it were catch-as-catch-can. The only insulation was the deep bank of pine and spruce boughs the men laid around the outside. One of the men promoted a complete set of storm windows for the place one day, but the 27 inmates of the special barracks were detailed up to Bangor that same day to help with some work at the base up there, and when they came back that night, tired and cold, all of those windows had been broken. Every one. This was in 1930, when half of America's Air Force still consisted of biplanes. In Washington, Billy Mitchell had been court-martialed and demoted to flying a desk because his gadfly insistence on trying to build a more modern Air Force had finally irritated his elders enough for them to slap him down hard. Not long after, he would resign. So there was precious little flying that went on at the Derry base, in spite of its three runways, one of which was actually paved. Most of the soldiering that went on there was of the make-work variety. One of the Company E soldiers who returned to Derry after his service tour came to an end in 1937 was my dad. He told me this story. One day in the spring of 1930, this was about 6 months before the fire at the Black Spot, I was coming back with four of my buddies from a three-day pass we had spent down in Boston. When we come through the gate, there is this big old boy standing just inside the checkpoint, leaning on a shovel and picking the seat of his suntans out of his ass. A sergeant from some place down south. Carroty red hair, bad teeth, pimples. Not much more than an ape without the body hair, if you know what I mean. There were a lot of them like that in the Army during the Depression. So here we come, four young guys back from leave, all of us still feeling fine, and we could see in his eyes that he was just looking for something to bust us with. So we snapped him salutes as if he was General Blackjack Pershing himself. I guess we might have been all right. But it was one fine late April day, sun shining down, and I had to shoot off my lip. "A good afternoon to you, Sergeant Wilson, sir," said I. And he landed on me with both feet. "Did I give you any permission to speak to me?" he asks. "No, sir," I say. He looks around at the rest of them, Trevor Dawson, Carl Roone, and Henry Whitson, who was killed in the fire that fall, and he says to them, "This here smart nigger is in hack with me. If the rest of you jigaboos don't want to join him in one hard-working, dirty bitch of an afternoon, you get over to your barracks, stow your gear, and get your asses over to the O.D. You understand?" Well, they got going, and Wilson hollers, "Double time, you fuckers. Let me see the soles of your 80-fucking-nines." So they double-timed off. Yeah, Wilson took me over to one of the equipment sheds, and he got me a spade. He took me out into the big field that used to be just about where the Northeast Airlines Airbus terminal stands today. And he looks at me, kind of grinning, and he points at the ground and he says, "You see that hole there, nigger?" There was no hole there, but I figured it was best for me to agree with whatever he said, so I looked down at the ground where he was pointing and said I sure did see it. So then he busted me one in the nose and knocked me over, and there I was on the ground with blood running down over the last fresh shirt I had. "You don't see it because some big mouth jig bastard filled it up," he shouted at me, and he had two big blotches of color on his cheeks. But he was grinning, too, and you could tell he was enjoying himself. "So what do, Mr. A Good Afternoon to You? What you do is you get the dirt out of my hole. Double time." So I dug for almost 2 hours, and pretty soon I was in that hole up to my chin. The last couple of feet was clay, and by the time I finished, I was standing in water up to my ankles, and my shoes were soaked right through. "Get out of there, Hanlon," Sergeant Wilson said. He was sitting there in the grass, smoking a cigarette. He didn't offer me any help. I was dirt and muck from top to bottom, not to mention the blood drying on the blouse of my suntans. He stood up and walked over. He pointed at the hole. "What you see there, nigger?" he asked me. "Your hole, Sergeant Wilson," says I. "Yeah, well, I decided I don't want it," he says. "I don't want no hole dug by a nigger. Put my dirt back in, Private Hanlon." So I filled it back in, and by the time I was done, the sun was going down and it was getting cold. He comes over and looks at it after I finished patting down the last of the dirt with the flat of the spade. "Now what do you see there, nigger?" he asks. "Bunch of dirt, sir," I said, and he hit me again. My God, Mikey, I came this close to just bouncing up off on the ground and splitting his head open with the edge of that shovel. But if I'd done that, I never would have looked at the sky again except through a set of bars. Still, there were times when I almost think it would have been worth it. I managed to hold my peace somehow, though. "That ain't a bunch of dirt, you stupid coontail night fighter," he screams at me, the spit flying off on his lips. "That's my hole, and you best get the dirt out of it right now, double time." So I dug the dirt out of his hole, and then I filled it in again. And then he asks me why I went and filled in his hole just when he was getting ready to take a crap in it. So I dug it out again, and he drops his pants and hangs his skinny shanks cracker redneck ass over the hole, and he grins up at me while he's doing his business and says, "How you doing, Hanlon?" "I am doing just fine, sir," I says right back, because I had decided I wasn't going to give up until I felt unconscious or dropped dead. I had my dander up. "Well, I aim to fix that," he says. "To start with, you better just fill that hole in, Private Hanlon, and I want to see some life. You're slowing down." So I got her filled in again, and I could see by the way he was grinning that he was only warming up. But just then this friend of his came humping across the field with a gas lantern and told him there'd been a surprise inspection and Wilson was in hack for having missed it. My friends covered for me and I was okay, but Wilson's friends, if that's what he called them, couldn't be bothered. He let me go then, and I waited to see if his name would go up on the punishment roster the next day, but it never did. I guess he must have just told the loot he missed the inspection because he was teaching a smart-mouthed nigger who it was owned all the holes at the dairy base, those that had already been dug and those that hadn't been. They probably gave him a medal instead of potatoes to peel. And that's how things were for Company E here in Derry. It was right around 1958 that my father told me the story, and I guess he was pushing 50, although my mother was only 40 or so. I asked him if that was the way Derry was. Why had he come back? "Well, I was only 16 when I joined the Army, Mikey," he said. "Lied about my age to get in. Wasn't my idea either. My mother told me to do it. I was big, and that's the only reason the lie stuck, I guess. I was born and grew up in Burgaw, North Carolina. And the only time we saw meat was right after the tobacco was in. Or sometimes in the winter if my father shot a coon or a possum. The only good thing I remember about Burgaw is possum pie with hoe cake spread around her just as pretty as you could want. So when my dad died in an accident with some farm machinery, my ma said she was going to take Philly Bluebird up to Corinth, where she had people. Philly Bluebird was the baby of the family." "You mean my Uncle Phil?" I asked, smiling to think of anybody calling him Philly Bluebird. He was a lawyer in Tucson, Arizona, and had been on the city council there for 6 years. When I was a kid, I thought Uncle Phil was rich. For a black man in 1958, I suppose he was. He made $20,000 a year. "That's who I mean," my dad said. But in those days, he was just a 12-year-old kid who wore a rice paper sailor hat and mended byballs and had no shoes. He was the youngest. I was the second youngest. All the others were gone. Two dead, two married, one in jail. That was Howard. He never was any good. "You are going to join the army," your Grandma Shirley told me. "I don't know if they start paying you right away or not, but once they do, you're going to send me allotment every month. I hate to send you away, son, but if you don't take care of me in Philly, I don't know what's going to become of us." She gave me my birth certificate to show the recruiter, and I seen she fixed the year on it somehow to make me 18. So I went to the courthouse where the army recruiter was and asked about joining up. He showed me the papers and the line where I could make my mark. "I can write my name," I said, and he laughed like he didn't believe me. "Well then, you go on and write it, black boy," he says. "Hang on a minute," I says back. "I want to ask you a couple of questions." "Fire away then," he says. "I can answer anything you can ask." "Do they have meat twice a week in the army?" I asked. "My mama says they do, but she is powerful set on me joining up." "No, they don't have it twice a week," he says. "Well, that's about what I thought," I says, thinking that the man surely does seem like a booger, but at least he's an honest booger. Then he says, "They got it every night," making me wonder how I ever could have thought he was honest. "You must think I'm a pure D fool," I says. "You got that right, nigger," he says. "Well, if I join up, I got to do something for my mama and Philly Bluebird," I says. "Mama says it's allotment." "That's this here," he says, and taps the allotment form. "Now what else is on your mind?" "Well," says I, "what about training to be an officer?" He threw his head back when I said that and laughed until I thought he was going to choke on his own spit. Then he says, "Son, the day they got nigger officers in this man's army will be the day you see the bleeding Jesus Christ doing the Charleston at Birdland. Now you sign or you don't sign. I'm out of patience. Also, you're stinking the place up." So I signed and watched him staple the allotment form to my muster sheet, and then he'd give me the oath, and then I was a soldier. I was thinking that they'd send me up to New Jersey, where the army was building bridges on account of there being no wars to fight. Instead, I got Derry, Maine, and Company E. He sighed and shifted in his chair, a big man with white hair that curled close to his skull. At that time, we had one of the bigger farms in Derry, and probably the best roadside produce stand south of Bangor. The three of us worked hard, and my father had to hire on extra help during harvesting time, and we made out. He said, "I came back because I'd seen the South, and I'd seen the North, and there was the same hate in both places. It wasn't Sergeant Wilson that convinced me of that. He was nothing but a Georgia cracker, and he took the South with him wherever he went.